Good morning, and welcome to Greater Good. This is your volunteer programmer, Barbara Felix, from the Sun Sounds of Arizona Studios. The Greater Good Science Center studies the psychology, sociology, and neuroscience of well-being, and teaches skills that foster a thriving, resilient, and compassionate society. And now, some articles from Greater Good. Can loving yourself and others protect your health? Research suggests that seeing our spiritual connections to others could protect us from disease and promote public health. By Ganga Bay, November 18th, 2025. You're not your body. You're a spirit soul. I often heard this refrain growing up as an unlikely Hindu in a black body in Cleveland, Ohio. While this idea may sound foreign to many in the Western world, it is foundational in several Eastern philosophies, which teach that attachment to the physical body as the self is the root cause of suffering. Now, as a social theorist and epidemiologist studying population health, I often reflect on that early lesson. I see more clearly than ever that the supposed divide between science and spirituality is a false one. Our conceptions of self, fundamentally spiritual ideas about who and what we are not merely abstract philosophies. They are measurable, powerful determinants of health and well-being. And in this age of preventable crises, climate change, hunger, economic inequality, disease, they may be one of our most untapped resources for survival and flourishing. I can't really say this realization surprised me. All my life, I watched my mother embody a belief in herself first as a soul connected to all other souls. This conviction guided her through life, defined by compassion, gratitude, advocacy, sacrifice, and countless other generosities of spirit. Qualities consistently linked to better mental and physical health. And indeed, my mother was a model of both. While many of her family and community members developed chronic illnesses as they aged, diabetes, heart disease, premature cognitive decline, bipolar disorder, my mother, whom many called Mata, the Sanskrit word for mother, remained remarkably vital throughout her life. Mata's health thrived despite the immense challenges she faced: gender abuse, poverty, racism, and other forms of trauma, stressors that weigh hardest upon marginalized populations in inequitable societies. Drawn to understanding health from a young age, I pondered the nature of her resilience. What made her so strong? Was it her disidentification with the physical body that was so protective? And could others cultivate that same resilience? For much of my youth, I wanted to be a physician. I entered college intent on majoring in biology and becoming a cardiologist. The heart somehow seemed at the center of every illness I saw in the black and brown communities where I grew up. But during my second year at Princeton, a medical anthropology course shifted my understanding of health entirely. I began to see that the diseases of the heart in my community weren't simply biological. They were social, born from inequality, racism, and chronic exposure to toxic stress. I changed my major to anthropology and African American studies, but stayed on the pre-med track, determined to bridge biology and society in my understanding of health. Still, something kept tugging at me. Mata's quiet, steady strength. Even as I came to understand how social structures shape health outcomes, I couldn't stop thinking about the inner posture that had sustained her. What role did her spiritual sense of identity play in her resilience? As an epidemiologist, I became fascinated by how self-identification might buffer people from the health impacts of chronic stress. While many health disparities, scholars focus on structural determinants, I saw an opportunity to integrate insights from Eastern philosophy, social psychology, and population health to bring to light understudied sources of resilience. In the first year of my doctoral program, I began to formalize this integration into what I now call the Identity Vitality Pathology, TM, or IVP model. The model was inspired directly by Mata's example. I identified three key dimensions of her belief in the self as distinct from the physical body that I believed were central to its health protective power. A sense of self that includes all living beings, a belief in the intrinsic and immutable worth of all life, and a natural compassion that flows from this recognition of shared value. Together, these qualities form what I call identity vitality, a loving state of being rooted in connection and compassion that is directed toward self and others. By contrast, when a person defines selfhood narrowly through physical characteristics, social status, or the exclusion of others, they fall into what I call identity pathology. In this state, I argue, it is inherently harmful both to self and society because it constrains compassion and ultimately reinforces inequity. We all exist somewhere along this spectrum. Those who orient toward identity vitality, I hypothesize, are more resilient to the health effects of chronic stress, while those oriented toward identity pathology are more vulnerable. How does identity vitality protect health? Stress, after all, is a curious companion to health. In brief doses, it helps us to adapt and grow. But chronic, unrelenting stress, like the social burdens imposed upon marginalized people, erodes health across every system of the body. Over time, it accelerates aging and contributes to conditions from diabetes to heart disease to Alzheimer's and cancer. Yet, not everyone is equally affected. Some people, like Mata, seem buffered from many of its worst effects. Genetics plays a role, yes, but perhaps so does how we see ourselves in the world. I theorize that identity vitality is a key factor that shapes whether stress becomes toxic or transformative. To test this theory, I developed a questionnaire to measure identity vitality and pathology. In my lab, the Healthy Aging with Resilient Identities, or HARI, H-A-R-I, lab, our research explores whether cultivating a vitalized identity can promote healthier aging. The empirical evidence, though early, is promising. In studies including more than 2,700 Black and white adults aged 18 to 81, we found that greater identity vitality was consistently linked with lower risk of depression, even after accounting for many other relevant factors. The relationship showed a striking dose-response effect. As identity vitality increased, the risk of depression declined by as much as 90%. In another study, Black women with higher identity vitality had a 50% lower risk of hypertension associated with neighborhood disadvantage. Among men experiencing severe financial strain, those with higher identity vitality also reported better overall health. These findings suggest that the way that we understand who we are may literally shape how our bodies bear stress. Can identity vitality really improve population health outcomes? I use the terms vitalized and pathologized deliberately to emphasize that identity states are constructed and thus potentially modifiable. We are all taught implicitly or explicitly what to believe about who we are and what gives us worth. But those lessons can be unlearned and relearned at any point in life. If identity vitality can be cultivated, then perhaps resilience itself is teachable. My confidence in that idea was shaken when my mother was diagnosed with an aggressive uterine cancer at 65 during my final year of doctoral training. Less than 2 years later, she had physically departed. Her passing forced me to confront painful questions. How could someone so mindful of her health, whose deep and practical spiritual beliefs guided every aspect of her life, including her health behaviors, succumb to such an aggressive, merciless illness? In grief, I found a new kind of clarity. In a certain way, my mother's life and death mirrored an ongoing debate in public health. Can individual-level interventions, those targeting mindset, belief, or behavior, truly move the needle on population-level outcomes when structures at the root of health disparities remain? My mother's identity vitality had clearly buffered her from many stress-related diseases. Yet even her profound resilience couldn't entirely protect her from the deeper structural inequities that shape who gets sick with what illness. Non-Hispanic Black women are nearly twice as likely as women of other racial and ethnic groups to die from uterine cancers. Stressors stemming from structural inequities rooted in racism, sexism, and economic inequality accumulate in the body in ways that even the most resilient spirit may not overcome. Because my mother had largely avoided the chronic conditions so often tied to lifestyle and behavior, I began to wonder if I had been somewhat blinded to the constraints imposed by structural inequity. Over time, however, I came to see that this harsh reality didn't negate the promise of identity vitality. It offered a path for greater healing. Now I see identity vitality as both a conduit for individual resilience and a catalyst for collective transformation. The same beliefs that protect us from stress on the personal level, seeing all beings as valuable, releasing attachment to hierarchy or status, may also dismantle the systems that create inequity, and with them, the need for resilience itself. These systems persist because so many of us are taught to derive our worth from perceiving ourselves as superior to others. If more of us underwent what I call a vitalizing transformation, a shift from self-worth based on comparison to self-worth rooted in universal connection, intrinsic value, and compassion for ourselves and others, then the decision points that sustain inequity might begin to shift as well. Were we able to create an identity inoculant, perhaps we could begin to heal the social diseases of dominance the way we once eradicated polio and smallpox, through collective courage, compassion, and persistence. The turning points that sustain or undo systems of power are not abstract. They live within the human choices. Each decision to reinforce hierarchy or dismantle it is shaped by the identity state of the decision maker. The more people who see themselves as connected rather than separate, as part of a family of all beings rather than a social ladder, the more our collective choices will tilt toward justice and care for ourselves, for each other, and for the earth. As those levers of power slowly shift, individuals too would feel the change ripple inward. Our values might evolve. Our ideas about leadership might expand. We might begin to choose and elevate those whose sense of worth is grounded in the recognition that all living beings are inherently valuable, in inclusion rather than exclusion, and even as systems transform at their own pace, every person retains an immediate source of power, the ability to vitalize their own identity, to nurture health and compassion within themselves, and to model a way of being that quietly reshapes the world around them. The next steps. The next phase of my work, understanding how identity states are transmitted and how they might be transformed at scale, is still in its early stages. But I find comfort and inspiration in knowing that the lesson my mother lived by was more than spiritual poetry. It was an early glimpse into a phenomenon that natural science is only beginning to quantify. I'm not sure whether we are not our bodies, and perhaps the journey toward that answer extends beyond what any net physical science can tell. My work does give me confidence, however, that what we believe about who we are matters profoundly for our capacity to sustain our health, even in the face of tremendous stress. More important, our decision to see all living beings as part of ourselves, to engage in this loving practice of extending our ego boundaries to include others, to accept the intrinsic worth of every being, and to offer compassion generously, may be among the most powerful public health interventions we could ever implement. About the author, Ganga Bay, PhD, is an assistant professor at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Her research draws on geroscience and social psychological perspectives to explore the social and epigenetic mechanisms that influence disparate aging rates over the life course across social groups. You are listening to Greater Good Magazine, brought to you by Sun Sounds of Arizona. And next we have time for a Greater Good in Action practice, and this one is called Three Good Things, a way to tune into the positive events in your life. How to do it. Time required. 10 minutes per day for at least 1 week. How to do it. Each day for at least 1 week, write down three things that went well for you today and provide an explanation for why they went well. It is important to create a physical record of your items by writing them down. This can be more helpful than simply doing this exercise in your head. The items can be small, everyday events, or more important milestones. For example, I got out of bed today. My grandparents were happy when I brought them groceries. Or, I earned a big promotion. To make this exercise part of your daily routine, some find that writing before bed is helpful. As you write, follow these instructions. Number one, give the event a title. For example, I received a compliment on something I've been working hard on. Two, write down exactly what happened in as much detail as possible, including where you were, what you did or said, and if others were involved, what they did or said. Three, include how this event made you feel at the time and how this event made you feel later, including now as you remember it. Four, explain what you think caused this event, why it happened. Five, use whatever writing style you please, and don't worry about grammar or spelling. Use as much detail as you'd like. Six, if you find yourself focusing on negative feelings, try to refocus your mind on the good event and the positive feelings that came with it. This can take effort, but gets easier with practice and can make a real difference in how you feel. Why you should try it. In our day-to-day lives, it's easy to get caught up in the things that go wrong and feel like we're living under our own private rain cloud. At the same time, We tend to adapt to the good things and people in our lives, taking them for granted. As a result, we often overlook everyday beauty and goodness, a kind gesture from a stranger, say, or the warmth of the sun on a chilly morning. In the process, we frequently miss opportunities for happiness and connection. Why it works. By giving you the space to focus on the positive, this practice teaches you to notice, remember, and savor the better things in life. It may prompt you to pay closer attention to positive events down the road and engage in them more fully, both in the moment and later on when you can reminisce and share these experiences with others. You've been listening to Greater Good Magazine, coming to you from Sun Sounds of Arizona. This is your volunteer programmer, Barbara Felix. Thank you so much for listening today, and I hope that you have a wonderful rest of your day. And now, stay tuned for more interesting programming coming to you from Sun Sounds of Arizona.